On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
We finished second, and I want to tell you something. I'm just honored. I'm really honored. And I want to congratulate Ted, and I want to congratulate all of the incredible candidates, including Mike Huckabee, who's become a really good friend of mine. So congratulations to everybody.
Tonight here in Iowa, the people of this great state have sent a very clear message. After 7 years of Barack Obama, we are not waiting any longer to take our country back.
Marco Rubio there taking a victory lap last night, and Donald Trump giving something of a concession speech. But wait, didn't Trump place in second and Rubio third? Ted Cruz, of course, took home the top prize, while Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders came in a very close second after Hillary Clinton, and Rubio came in third. Those two might be the big winners in the race going forward. To try to make sense of this, we've called on Molly Ball of The Atlantic. She's on her cell phone at the Des Moines airport, hoping her flight doesn't get canceled. Hi.
Hi. Good to be here.
It's pretty snowy,
well,
I imagine.
It'd be better to be home.
Yes.
Good to be here.
You're on your way to New Hampshire, I assume.
Well, I'm on my way home for a day, and then I'll go to New Hampshire.
Okay. So
taking a little break.
Talking about New Hampshire, everyone's focused on that now. Everyone's saying, look, Marco Rubio is the winner, even though he came in third. And he got 23% of the vote compared to Ted Cruz's 27%. So how is it that he is considered a winner?
Well, up is down, black is white, dogs and cats living together. It's true he came in third, but Rubio really had a late surge and dramatically outdid his sort of polling results, which means that a lot of Republican primary voters are gravitating to Rubio as this race intensifies and moves from Iowa to New Hampshire. So the reason we in the perplexing pundit class say that he's winning is that there's a movement to him. There's momentum on his side. There's voters moving in his direction. He was at 15% in the final Des Moines Register poll, ended up getting 23% of the vote, almost overtaking Donald Trump for second place. That is dramatically better than anybody thought Rubio was going to do.
Right. So he was just one percentage point, or even a little less than one percentage point, behind Donald Trump. So is it now a three-man race?
It sure looks like that. But, I mean, we're certainly going to hear from some of the other candidates in New Hampshire arguing with that premise. But I think what Rubio's result does is it takes a lot of the oxygen away from the other quote-unquote establishment candidates. It means it's going to be real hard for a Chris Christie, a John Kasich, or especially a Jeb Bush to get any oxygen in New Hampshire for the argument that they're the one who's going to consolidate the votes of the apparently half to two-thirds of the Republican Party that doesn't want to see Donald Trump or Ted Cruz become the nominee.
Well, speaking of Trump, coming in second seems to be a real blow to his winner image. And how do you think that he will fare going forward?
Well, it's going to be real interesting to see what he says. We've had him lashing out on Twitter a little bit, saying that he's not getting enough credit for second place. But this is someone who, as you say, has been a hashtag winner in his own description all his life, and certainly in this race and in all the polls. We kept hearing how he was going to win. He was going to win. Now he comes out second and says, oh, I should get credit for that because nobody ever would have said I could win Iowa. Well, a year ago, I don't think a lot of people would have said that Donald Trump was going to win the Iowa caucuses. But what happened was there were a lot of people telling pollsters that they were going to go out and vote for him. And then when push came to shove, they didn't show up.
Mm. Any reason why? Does anyone know why that happened?
Well, Trump was counting on a lot of first-time caucus goers. Mm-hmm. He was counting on a lot of new voters, and any political scientist will tell you that those are the least reliable voters. A caucus is a tough thing to get to. It's a weird process to engage in. You got to be in a particular place at a particular time. It takes a lot of commitment. And Trump did not build the sort of old-fashioned campaign infrastructure that it takes to make sure your voters get out. He was counting on a sort of much more informal network. You know, he had people phone banking and maybe not knocking on doors so much, but he was sending letters to people, and that wasn't enough compared to this very sophisticated ground game that especially Ted Cruz was deploying in Iowa.
Yeah, so now do you think that Trump will start employing a ground game in other states?
It's probably too late. And the ground game doesn't matter quite as much in primary states as it does in caucus states. Because turnout is so low for a caucus and because the timing is so precise in a caucus, the mechanics of getting your supporters there are much more crucial. In a primary state, turnout's going to be a lot higher no matter what. Independents can vote in New Hampshire. Trump, you know, as of yesterday, was way ahead in the polls in New Hampshire. It's likely we'll see a shift, not necessarily away from Trump, but just a shift in general now that the votes are done in Iowa. We don't know which way that's going to go. But it's probably too late to build a ground game from scratch.
Okay, let's talk about someone who has a really good ground game in New Hampshire, and that is Bernie Sanders. So he is predicted to walk away with that. Let's talk a little bit about Iowa and what he did there. It seems to be a split in terms of the conventional wisdom, whether or not he won really big or didn't win really big last night by coming in a close second. What do you think?
Well, he tied. And Hillary edged him out just barely. And it's true. There's a lot of fighting now about what this means, with the Hillary people saying that they won because they didn't lose, and the Bernie people saying that they won because they almost won. And I think both those things are true. I think it is a tremendous testament to the appeal of Bernie's message that he was able to effectively tie the supposedly inevitable front runner in Iowa, which is not necessarily the best state for his message. And he does look a lot stronger in New Hampshire, where he's from a neighboring state. And he is a very natural fit for that electorate. On the other hand, you know, Hillary did win, and she lost 8 years ago, and she really didn't want to relive that. And there was a fear, there was a lot of nervousness on her team. There was a fear that there might be a blowout, and that would have really been crippling. So she did win by not losing, but he also won by almost winning.
And some people are saying he should have won a lot more, because this is a state that you would think he would do really well in. A lot of white, older, middle-class and working-class voters who would naturally be his constituency. So some are saying, shouldn't he have walked away with this vote?
No, I mean, I've spent a lot of time with Iowa Democrats, and a lot of them are sort of middle-of-the-road Democrats. I mean, if you remember Obama winning 8 years ago, he didn't win a majority of the vote. He won about a third of it. It was a little more than a third. So there is obviously a base that Bernie tapped into of young people and liberals, particularly in urban areas. I saw him get impressive turnout also in rural areas where there was a feeling on the part of some liberals, like he was speaking for a philosophy that they hadn't been able to express in a long time, and they were very gratified by that. But I do think there's a large sort of moderate core of the Democratic electorate in Iowa. It gets harder for Bernie after New Hampshire. When you go on to South Carolina, when you go on to Nevada, when there are more minority voters, I think those are seen as a natural constituency for Hillary. So the question is going to be less, can he win in New Hampshire, although that's important, but can he carry that forward?
Right. And let's talk about the youth vote there. Last night, he won 84% of the under 30 youth vote to Clinton's 14%, which is quite remarkable for a 74-year-old man. So what does that mean going forward?
This is a problem for Hillary, because this is something that she's going to need for the primary, but also for the general election. And this goes to the problem that we talk about that's at the heart of her issues, which is the enthusiasm. You see a lot of sort of rank-and-file Democrats, regular Democratic voters, people who have been voting Democrat all their lives, who are happy to support Hillary Clinton, even if they're not particularly thrilled about it. But the sort of young, idealistic, you know, college students and post-college students, their heart isn't with her. And even if she gets the nomination, it's going to be hard for her to inspire that sense of passion, the sense of a movement that was such an asset in both of Barack Obama's elections.
Does Marco Rubio get the youth vote on the Republican side?
There's not much of a youth vote on the Republican side, frankly. You know, we talk about Rubio being a relatively youthful candidate. He's in his mid-40s, and so he looks young next to all the other ones. But I don't think that's a big part of his appeal. I think Rubio's appeal is much more about the suburban vote, the not necessarily moderate, but sort of mainstream Republican vote, the sort of rank-and-file Republicans who are scared by Trump, scared by Cruz, and would like to see a nominee that they view as electable.
Molly Ball, political reporter for The Atlantic magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the O.J. Simpson miniseries debuts tonight. It's based on Jeffrey Toobin's book. He'll be here to talk about the real characters in this story and where they are now and why the trial is still relevant today. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 20 years ago, defense lawyer Johnny Cochran delivered his closing argument in the O.J. Simpson trial. At one point, he put on a knit cap, the same kind prosecutor said Simpson wore when he murdered Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman.
If I put this knit cap on, who am I? I'm still Johnny Cochran with a knit cap. And if you look at O.J. Simpson over there, and he has a rather large head, O.J. Simpson in a knit cap from two blocks away is still O.J. Simpson. It's no disguise. It's no disguise. It makes no sense. It doesn't fit. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
One of many theatrical moments in a case that became a television circus and a cultural touchstone. Now it's getting a second run. Tonight, the series The People versus O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story, debuts on FX. It's based on a book by New Yorker staff writer Jeffrey Toobin, The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson. And Jeffrey Toobin is here now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, you're actually a character in this series, I understand. What was your role in real life back 20 years ago?
Well, my role was mostly to be a much younger journalist than I am today. And what sort of put me on the map in the case and really in the journalism world was I wrote a story about shortly after the preliminary hearing that Mark Furman, who was one of the detectives in the case, had a history of real bad relationships with African Americans, and that the defense, in light of that, was planning on claiming that he tried to frame O.J. Simpson by planting a glove at Simpson's house.
And you found that he actually sued the LAPD, I understand.
Right. I was looking. I had gotten a tip from Alan Dershowitz, who had actually been my criminal law professor in law school, and he said to me, you know, we think this cop is a bad guy, which, you know, was not much to go on, but I went down to the bowels of the Superior Court in L.A., downtown L.A., thinking that, well, I may find that he had been the defendant in a bunch of civil rights cases, because that's often what happens with bad cops. But in fact, I found that he had been a plaintiff in a case suing to get a pension from the LAPD because he had become someone consumed by hatred of African Americans. That was certainly a great deal of interest for me. And I also think it was kind of revealing about the LAPD that he was denied the pension and told, no, go back to work.
Right. So that kind of made your career. This case made a lot of people's careers, and it unmade some people's careers. Gil Garcetti, the DA, for one of them.
Right.
Let's talk about what has happened to some of the principal characters in this trial. Johnny Cochran, we just heard from, he died in 2005. What did he do in the 10 years after the trial ended, though?
You know, I have to say, it's been pointed out by people who read the book recently that I'm kind of hard on Johnny Cochran in the book. And, you know, I grew to really love Johnny Cochran. This is someone who devoted a great deal of his life to trying to help what he called the no-jays. He was a real civil rights pioneer. And yes, you know, he wanted to make a good living, and he certainly did. But I really thought Johnny was a fine, fine person and a very good lawyer. And he moved to New York, part-time. He worked at Court TV when Court TV existed as well as practicing law. But he got brain cancer and died way too young, 10 years ago.
Yeah. And Barry Scheck, he became the co-founder and director of the Innocence Project, along with Peter Neufeld.
You know, Barry Scheck, I mean, just sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
You know, when if you were to rank all the lawyers in the United States in the past 100 years in terms of their contributions to society, Barry Scheck would be near the very, very top. The Innocence Project has had an enormous impact, of course, on their clients, but just also on perceptions of criminal law, on the death penalty, because people see how imperfect the system is. I mean, Barry has done an amazing, amazing job, and Barry and I long ago agreed to disagree about the O.J. Simpson case.
Because he believes that O.J. is innocent?
I don't want to characterize Barry's view. I think he believes with all his heart that O.J. was framed, which I don't. But I think he also believes he's innocent, but I was never quite going that way.
What about his other lawyers, the other members of the defense team? Did they all believe in his innocence?
Well, interestingly, the one who believes most passionately in his innocence to this day is F. Lee Bailey, who has had perhaps the most stormy post-trial career. He was actually disbarred in the state of Florida for a financial misdeeds and has moved to Maine, tried to become a lawyer there. The bar turned him down, even though he had the highest score on the bar exam. And so at 80 years old, he's putting himself out as a legal consultant. He has a whole elaborate theory about how O.J. was innocent. Robert Shapiro, I think, has been more or less open with his belief that O.J. is guilty. Bob has gone on to be a legal entrepreneur. He is a co-founder of LegalZoom. People may remember seeing the commercials on TV. And he's been very successful with that. He practices law. Much less now.
And then there's Robert Kardashian. He also died. He died in 2003. He was a close friend of O.J. Simpson's. And, you know, now we know the Kardashian name for other members of his family. What do you make of that? I mean, I guess...
Just the bizarreness of this case just never stops.
Yeah.
You know, who would have thought that Robert Kardashian, whose job really was to babysit O.J. just to sit at the counsel table. He didn't do any lawyering. He would turn out to have the most famous name in the whole case. And one of the wonderful things in the miniseries, which starts, David Schwimmer's portrayal of him. And you know, he was actually a very private person and a religious person. And there are a couple very amusing scenes in retrospect with him and his young daughters, Kim and Chloe. And you just start to see the beginning of the Kardashian empire. But I assure you, sitting there in the courtroom, I would have bet against it.
Hmm. Well, you know, it is really interesting. Some people say that O.J. did usher in this age of reality TV, in a sense, and you know, no one could have foretold, because at the time there was really no internet to speak of. And yet it was such a precursor to what we have today.
I think the fact that there was no Fox News, there was no MSNBC, and as you point out, no internet, made it all the more ubiquitous in the mid-90s, because we didn't have the number of choices that we have now in terms of what we want to watch. Even if you had cable, you had a relative handful of stations to watch. So CNN and Court TV, which is sadly gone, were your only options for watching news during the day. And you were subjected to the O.J. case whether you wanted to or not. That's not true anymore. And that's
right.
Why one of the reasons why I don't think you could ever have a case with this sort of impact anymore.
Right. So because of the multitude of possibilities for our attention.
Right.
Yeah. But what about in terms of the cultural significance and what it tells us about the relationship between Black defendants and the police? I mean, we are in a Ferguson moment right now, and so it does seem that this case is even more relevant today, perhaps, than it was back then.
you know, I had an editor who once said that, you know, good stories always turn out to be topical. And the fact that the series is coming out now does seem almost astonishing in its timeliness, because, you know, as I think most people, especially in L.A., will remember, the defense strategy here was to put the LAPD on trial, and with a largely African-American jury, just 2 years after Rodney King and so many other bad incidents between the LAPD and the African-American community there, people were prepared to believe bad things about the LAPD. We are now, thanks to the existence of cell phone cameras, which of course didn't exist in the mid-90s, we are literally seeing with our own eyes evidence of how often African Americans are treated badly by the police. And this is something that you know, makes the defense in this in the OJ case all the more relevant and revealing.
So in real life, the defense, the lawyers, most of them, they, you know, they went on to have really good careers. But on the other side, in the prosecution, they did not do so well. Gil Garcetti was turned out of office based mainly on this, on losing this case. Marcia Clark did not fare well, at least in the eyes of public opinion. Now she's a true crime fiction writer. Christopher Darden, where is he now?
He practices some law. He taught for a while. I think it's worth pointing out that both Chris Darden and Marcia Clark made enormous amounts of money on books about the case. So, I mean, you know, I wouldn't feel too sorry for them. I think one of the best parts of the American Crime Story are the portrayals of Chris and Marcia, because there's a lot of sympathy for them, because they were put in extremely difficult circumstances. Marcia Clark, a working mother with a difficult divorce that she was going through, incredibly sexist commentary in the news media about her and about her appearance. Chris Darden, being called essentially an Uncle Tom for pursuing this case, and you know, which I think was egregiously unfair. Again, I think they definitely made some mistakes. Marcia Clark, I think, was overconfident on her ability to overcome the racial issues. Chris Darden never should have asked O.J. Simpson to try on that glove in the courtroom. But I think this case was really lost at jury selection. So the individual courtroom errors, you know, while interesting to all of us who followed the case, were ultimately not all that important.
Right. I think that was the first time that many of us had heard the term jury nullification.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would characterize what the jury did as jury nullification. I think that's a more extreme view. It wasn't that the 12 people sat there and said, well, we know he's guilty, but we're going to find him not guilty anyway. There was a view of the evidence that could be taken, that the evidence was, in Johnny Cochran's words, corrupted, compromised, and thus unreliable. So I think it was a receptivity to certain arguments that were not persuasive to me, more than outright jury nullification.
Mm-hmm. So finally, O.J. Simpson himself, he's in prison, and he may spend the rest of his life in prison for armed robbery.
I think it's unlikely he'll spend the rest of his life. He's 68 years old. I think one of the crowning absurdities of the O.J. Simpson case was that, you know, he was acquitted of the crime he was guilty of and convicted of a crime he was innocent of. There was this very strange case several years ago in Las Vegas where he was convicted of stealing his own stuff, and essentially in a hotel room in a bizarre confrontation, and he was sentenced to 33 years, which I think is a wildly excessive sentence. Now, I don't stay up at night worrying about how sad it is that O.J. Simpson's in jail unjustly on this case, but, you know, the system is not supposed to work on a sort of karmic basis. You're supposed to be charged with the case, you know, in front of you. He's eligible for parole in 2017, and at his age, he may well get it, but, you know, he spent a long, long time in prison, and for someone his age, that's very unusual.
Well, thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks for walking down memory lane with us.
My pleasure.
That's Jeffrey Toobin. He wrote the book, The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson. It's the basis for the television series that begins tonight, The People versus O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story. It's on FX. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And what about you? Do you remember what you thought when the verdict was read? Have you changed your opinion or have your thoughts about the case changed since then? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or you can weigh in on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, sexual harassment and assault in the comedy world.
You're a female doing comedy. You don't want to be labeled as unfunny or difficult to work with. So if a group of guys is making jokes or sexist jokes or they're touching you inappropriately, it's just sort of easier to laugh it off.
How female comics are fighting back online. That's next on Press Play.
Ever wish you could hear KCRW's signature music programming wherever and whenever you want? You can with Eclectic 24. Our ever-expanding all-music stream is available worldwide 24/7 online. You can listen to KCRW's diverse music mix on the go or in the car through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out. Go to kcrw.com/eclectic24.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In the world of improv comedy, there's a concept known as yes and. It's the idea that you go along with your scene partner's premise to keep the story moving. So let's say I say I'm really cold. You say yes and here's a sweater. Well, this is a concept that some in the LA comedy scene say is being exploited by men to take advantage of their female comedy partners. And now some women are fighting back, going public with their stories of harassment and sexual assault. Joining me to talk about this is BuzzFeed News reporter Katie Baker. She wrote a comprehensive piece on the subject. It is called Yes and No. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Also with us, Gina Ippolito, comedian who does improv and she directs shows at UCB and Iowa West. Hi, Gina.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Dave Ross is here.
Hello.
Representing the men. Oh, my. Stand-up comedian in LA. No pressure for you.
All men. You're representing
every
all
last
of them.
One of them.
Well, okay.
He's also the host of the podcast Terrified, appropriately, on the Nerdist Network.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so let's start with you, Katie, because this all came to light recently with this comedian named Beth Stelling, and she posted pictures of herself on Instagram, posted pictures of her bruises, and she didn't name the guy who assaulted her, but she said it was her ex-boyfriend, and then everyone knew who it was in the comedy world. So talk a little bit about this story and why it resonated in the comedy world, if you would.
Sure. So I had actually been working on this story about how women in these private Facebook groups had been calling out bad behavior within the LA comedy community for months now. And I was wrapping it up when Beth Stelling decided to post photos of her bruises on Instagram. And a few days later, another female comedian, Courtney Peruso, followed. And these women actually weren't in the private Facebook groups, but what they had in common was that instead of going to the police or going to the theaters, they had decided that the easiest way to help other women in the community and protect them from their ex was to post about it on social media. And that is what has been happening in these groups. Gina is a member of one of the groups where once they have strength in numbers, you know, once women realize it's not just them, just like Beth and Courtney did, once these women, you know, saw all the comments piling up about specific men, they felt brave enough and ready to come forward.
Okay, so Gina, you are on this Facebook group.
Yes.
And you see all these stories. Uh-huh. Has this ever happened to you?
I've never been raped or sexually assaulted, thank God. I've definitely faced sort of that soft misogyny that a lot of female comedians face in the community. But I have helped sort of get the conversation going about by saying, hey, if anything has ever happened to you, you can come to me and give me names and I'll see if that's someone who has a pattern of behavior, basically. And it sort of ranges from when Courtney and Beth came forward, then that name did become public. There are a lot of other names that have not been made public.
So this guy, and it's public because he actually came out and defended himself. His name is Cale Hartman. And he said, you know, wow, I didn't do all this. And this is crazy that I'm being accused, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you make of that, that these are accusations that have not been proven in a court of law and yet could damage someone's career irrevocably?
In this case, it was something that Beth came forward. She had talked to Courtney about it. Their stories were very, very, very similar. Then they talked to two other exes who had similar stories. And when you have four women, all who have the exact same stories, to me, there should be no doubt. There should be no doubting these women. The statistics for false reports of rape is between 2 and 8%. So even if one of these women is lying, there's still three that are telling the truth.
All right, Dave. Now the spotlight is on you. Hello there. So what do you make of all this? I mean, does this ring true to you, or are you at all privy to these, maybe not this particular Facebook group, but these complaints that women comedians have?
I am privy to them. There is a part of me that is surprised I'm even here right now, because this is an issue that, even though I am very much in my female friend's corner, as hard as I try to be the best I can be, I couldn't possibly have the perspective on it that I could, because the world is different for women than it is for men. But what's great is that more and more and more men are really, really realizing that. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with men recently who were like, I didn't know. I just didn't know. The first thing that started it all was Yes All Women. That was huge. It was a hashtag that was started. It was basically that, yes, all women have a story of being intimidated by men. Is that pretty accurate?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It was a way for them to share their stories of everything from rape to just sort of soft misogyny that they've faced.
I have a bunch of friends that became active feminists because of Yes All Women that have written things online that are like, oh my God, I didn't know.
Now, Gina, talk a little bit about how this unfolds in the improv world, the yes and world.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, it's interesting because you are encouraged to sort of go along with whatever's happening in a scene, or you're a female doing comedy. You don't want to be labeled as unfunny or difficult to work with. So if a group of guys is making jokes or sexist jokes, or they're touching you inappropriately, it's just sort of easier to laugh it off, to be that cool girl that says, oh, yeah, I'm funny. I can hang. Have me on your improv team. Have me at your show. There's a lot of all male improv teams that I've seen do a scene where they label someone a woman and then they're immediately raping her. Or, you know, they label someone their mom and they're just being really disrespectful. There are women that I know that will go into an improv scene as a scientist, and then a guy will grab their boobs for no reason whatsoever. In the real world, improv is supposed to, not in all cases, but it often mimics real life. So in the real world, you wouldn't meet a scientist and then honk her boobs.
You're saying, Dave,
you're like a sigh of relief. I just hate that. No, it's not a sigh of relief. It was a sigh of, like, I hate that.
Yeah.
I hate misogyny. I have my whole life. When I started stand-up, there were a few of us that actively hated misogyny, and when we would see it at open mics, we would freak out and scream at the dudes who did it. It's more that we are all here to represent the good people in the world that want this stuff to stop, and like, more men are realizing it's a problem and getting behind these girls. Mm-hmm. It's their voice. They're being loud. They're taking care of it, and we're like, go you. What do you need? We'll do what you need.
But is part of the problem that it is unbalanced in terms of just who is on stage, Katie?
Well, I think that's a really important part of this, that for people who might not understand, these theaters, Upright Citizens Brigade, Iowa West, and others, they're also schools, and they're increasingly becoming important for aspiring actors. You know, I got a lot of email from people after my story, including from agents saying, you know, when I, you know, I'm trying to get people out on casting calls, they say you must have improv experience. You must have gone through classes at UCB. So these are professional spaces, you know, where if you feel uncomfortable, or if a teacher, most of the teachers and administrators are men, and if they're making women uncomfortable and women are quitting or not showing up because they don't feel comfortable saying something, it has professional repercussions for them.
Yeah.
I will say that especially improv and stand-up and sketch comedy, it's a weird world because they are professional spaces, but these are also people that you're dating, that you're hanging out with. So it is a little bit of a blurred lines situation. I've had a lot of guys sort of ask me, well, how do I know that I'm not going to, like, end up being named? And I'll just say, well, have you ever done anything like super inappropriate? And most of the times they have to think and they'll say like, well, I've been awkward around, because these are comedians, so they've been awkward around women. And I'll say, well, let me ask you something. Once it was evident that they wanted you to stop whatever you were doing, if you were hitting on her, if you were trying to be sexual with her, did you stop? And they'll say yes. And then I'll say, well, then you have nothing to worry about. So I think that the theaters are sort of playing catch up now, and it's important to make the space safe for women so that more women join, so that more women get into power, so that more women are teaching to then make it more like the actual real world.
Mm. And Dave, you know, this is, as Gina was mentioning, that this is, there are blurred lines here. Mm-hmm. A lot of comedy happens at night. There's some drinking involved. It's a party atmosphere. There's dating happening. I mean, do you ever feel like, gosh, I want to ask this girl out, but I think maybe she might take it the wrong way that I'm harassing her? Or do those conversations happen amongst the men?
Sure. Yeah. What you're saying, those gray areas are going to be hard to manage, but they are manageable. And every woman in my life is saying that sexual assault is a real problem. There's something about your mental state after it happens that makes it very, very difficult to do anything about it. And then there's something about the situation as well that makes it hard to go to the police. And then when they do go to the police, most of the time nothing happens. And after hearing that from a lot of women, I know for a fact that we have to do something about it. And so these people aren't out to get each other. Mm-hmm. They're trying to figure out how to deal with a really big, terrible problem.
The women in the Facebook groups that I wrote about were not complaining about men that came on to them and they said, I'm not interested, and they said, okay, sorry.
Right.
These were men that would not quit, would message them for months, would not listen to no. You know, one woman, Erica, it took her years to say something about her alleged rape, and she posted in the group asked, just saying the guy's name, and she didn't even really say what happened to her. And she, five women wrote to her, mm-hmm. telling her that they had had similar experiences. You know, Erica said to me, she never would have had a chance at doing anything about it if she hadn't posted in the group and hadn't talked to these women. And it was all private. His name wasn't out there. It was done very responsibly. But through that, she felt confident going to the theaters, and she felt eventually confident going to the police. And that is kind of a really good example, I think, of how these groups are empowering women to help each other.
And Gina, do you think that with the whole, you know, everything that's coming out about Bill Cosby, obviously he was a comedian, that this has sparked this kind of conversation?
I definitely think that case made it feel safer for women to come forward. I know that in speaking with some older female comics, they've said, oh, this would have never happened in our time. No one would have ever named names, let alone ever complained about assault or harassment. And I think that showed, hey, here's a huge group of women who all came forward to the point where you can't deny it with those numbers. Maybe we could do something like that on a smaller scale. And it felt, I mean, it's a terrifying thing for a lot of these women to come forward. If you have even one other person that shared this experience with you, you feel a little bit safer. You feel like if there is going to be blowback, if men are going to say, oh my God, I can't believe you named names on Facebook, you're sharing that blowback with another person, and it makes it a little bit easier. And I will say that in Erica's case, she did go to the police, because I've had a lot of guys say, let the police handle it. She went to the police. I think there was a case with seven women added their name saying, this man raped me. The man who raped Erica emailed her and apologized. And they brought all this evidence to the police. The police brought it to the DA. And last week, the DA dropped the case and said, rape cases are too hard to win. We're not prosecuting. So all of the people out there that are saying, don't do this, handle it through the proper channels. I would be curious what they think the proper channels are, because there is no justice in this case. This man is still, he has been banned from the theaters, but he's still, I have 150 mutual Facebook friends with him. He still hangs out. He still goes to parties. He's still around women who don't know who he is.
Could I also say that, like, everything about this issue is like hot button, every single part of it. And when you think about the idea of a list, it sounds already like a witch hunt. It does, just because it's a list. And so I get it when people are like, well, why would you do that? That's unfair. They're going to hunt people down. But listen to how Gina speaks. Listen to how Katie speaks. Think another step or two further than the idea of it just being a list. And the fact that this has gone unmanaged, untalked about even for a long time, there has to be something done.
I mean, do you talk about it on stage?
Absolutely not.
He doesn't want to touch
but
it.
But why not?
Well, it's not very funny.
Well, a lot of stuff on stage is ostensibly not funny.
Yeah, but I'm good, though.
I mean, what I mean to say is a lot of serious topics are tackled on stage.
Sure,
and no. And you can talk about the situation in a way that, yeah, is comedic, but also serious.
I mean, I was actually being honest. I it's not funny to me. I actually talk about a lot of personal pain and a lot of, like, I don't know, social justice-y types, much less now. But even when I have talked about things that bother me about the world or things I've gone through, I can only talk about them if I have distance. If I try to write about them in the middle of thinking about them intensely when it's a real, true problem, I literally do not think it's funny. And so it's not fair for me to try to make it funny to an audience, because it's not any talking about anything that involves, like, helping. You got to help these people. And sometimes you're just being angry.
Mm-hmm. It is very difficult.
You could just in at the theaters for teachers and coaches and administrators and other men who are maybe high up, for them to call it out seems to me like a really important part of this. And I've heard from a lot of people that take classes at these theaters that they have had coaches who will shut that stuff down and that it's so helpful because it really sets the tone for the class. And these are not people who are only doing politically correct sketches or improv exercises.
Right,
and there's
right.
room for error. And it's not like somebody who makes a misstep is kicked out of the classroom. But if you have the person in charge saying, hey, dude, that's not cool, I think that goes a long way.
Yeah.
But don't you run the risk of, I don't know, squelching no-holds-barred comedy where people should be able to say whatever they want, no matter how politically correct it is?
Well, yeah. I think that this is a good place to point out that we are comedians. And so we all have a sense of humor. And a fairly sick sense of humor, a lot of us, you know? Uh-huh. I love dark jokes, but it, like you just said, just like with social justice material, it has to be funny. Beth Stelling has rape jokes, and, you know, they come from her experience, but if they weren't amazing jokes coming from an amazing comedian, it would be very hard to watch, you know what I mean? No one's trying to quelch comedy, and all of us are kind of in this, like, I don't know. The people I talk to get that this is a problem, and also we have a sense of humor separate from that. Deal with the problem, and then also know that this is something that really upsets people. So it's okay to joke about things, but be a good comedian about it and make it funny, because otherwise it's hurtful. It just is.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being so honest and talking about this issue.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Dave Ross, stand-up comedian in L.A. He's host of the podcast Terrified on the Nerdist Network. Gina Ippolito is an improv performer. She's currently directing shows at UCB and Iowa West. And Katie Baker is a reporter at BuzzFeed, where you can read her article, Yes and No. We'll say yes to listening to Warren Olney at 1 o'clock on To The Point. He's here now with a preview. Hi.
I'm glad to hear you say yes. Hi. Good to see you. We're going to have a lot of fun on our program talking about the aftermath of the Iowa caucuses. A lot of fun for us. Maybe not for Mike Huckabee. Maybe not for Martin O'Malley. But for a lot of other people, I think. And we're going to have a lot to talk about, I think, for a long time to come. Big challenges ahead, certainly, for our most extraordinary candidate, Donald Trump, and for Hillary Clinton, and for a bunch of others. All those governors. How about those guys? You know, Bush.
The Jeb Bushes of the world?
Yeah.
The Kasichs of the world?
Yeah. Didn't
Where
do
are
too
they?
Well.
No.
Yeah, but they're the ones who know how to do it. They're experienced. They have run things, which is not true of the others, except for Hillary Clinton, of course, who ran a big department.
Right. Well, and you have senators doing really well last night.
Yes.
Three senators doing very well.
That's right.
So it's not necessarily inside or outside or...
Well, it depends. You know, Cruz certainly is an outsider in the Senate, it appears.
Yeah.
They detest him. Mario is... Rubio, excuse me, is very new to the Senate.
Sanders
first
as well.
Term, just like the guy we have now in the White House. Anyway, the dynamics are just absolutely fascinating, yeah. And we'll have a lot of fun talking about them.
Great. Okay, look forward to that at 1 o'clock. To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you. And coming up on this show, L.A. has never been a barbecue town until now, that is. We're going to tell you about some new joints you might want to check out next on Press Play.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Here in L.A., Korean barbecue is practically a staple food. We also have Thai barbecue, Mongolian barbecue, but American barbecue, you know, good old-fashioned ribs, brisket, and cornbread? Not so much. Until now, L.A. seems to be having a barbecue explosion. Catherine Spires is here to tell you all about it. She's a food writer and host of the podcast How It Got in Your Mouth, which explores culinary history. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
Historically, this hasn't been our bag, and I don't really understand why.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a mystery because Los Angeles does have a lot of people who move here from the South. And of course, there have always been some barbecue spots around town, but it's just never really caught on the way other cuisines have in Los Angeles.
Okay, so now you're saying it is catching on.
I'm saying it's catching on.
Why is it catching on now?
I was actually talking to the barbecue editor of Texas Monthly. And
they have their own barbecue editor.
They do. And he was saying that sometimes it just takes one or two spots to open up for the culture to sort of change around it and to more people to get interested in it. And he thinks that's what's happening in LA right now.
So who are these founding spots?
Well, there's some that I think laid the groundwork in the past few years. There's Bledsoe's, which they opened their Compton location in 2008 and then up by Hollywood 2013, I believe. And they sort of brought brisket to a lot of people, Southern-style brisket as opposed to deli-style brisket. This is new to a lot of people, and ribs. And then a few years after that, Big Mista started showing up at farmers markets. And they are also, just like Bledsoe's, they're more or less Texas-style. Mm-hmm. So again, with the brisket, Big Mista's actually has two brick-and-mortar locations now, and they make pastrami there that is amazing. And I'm not clear on if pastrami is really a traditional barbecued meat, but it's whatever. It's amazing.
It's delicious. So, well, remind us the difference between the different styles. There's Texas, there's South Carolina, there's North Carolina.
Yeah.
Is there another one?
Oh, man. Well, it depends on who you ask, because some people will tell you that there's four styles. There's Kansas City.
Oh, Kansas City. Yeah,
of course. Kansas City, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Texas. And some people will say, no, there's the Carolinas, there's Texas, there's Kansas City. If you're in Texas, you will be told that there's probably about 17 different styles just within Texas.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what are the main differences?
A lot of it has to do with the type of animal that's used, actually. Mm-hmm. Like Texas uses more cows because Texas barbecue was largely founded by immigrants from Central and Eastern Europe who came over to be cattle farmers. Whereas on the Atlantic coast, they brought in a lot more pigs over there. So it's much more pork-based. Plus, the immigrants tended to be from Northern Europe, and they had a lot of love for vinegar and mustard and that sort of thing. So there's a lot more sauces in the barbecue, in the Carolina-style barbecues, than there is in Texas, where it's mostly about the smoking of the meat. And then you can add sauce afterwards if you want.
So it's drier in Texas and wetter.
Yeah,
absolutely. On the Atlantic side. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now I'm wondering, is there a California version?
I'm going to say yes, because even the pitmasters, as you call a barbecue chef, the ones working here, like Neil Strouder, who is Big Mista, he sort of says that he does California-style barbecue, because even though his family is from Texas and he trained a lot in Texas, he's not beholden to any rules. And I think that is so Californian of these guys, whereas everywhere else, the region you're in, that's the kind of barbecue you're going to make. One of the new places that I really like is called Barrel and Ashes. That's in Studio City. They sort of present themselves as Texas style on the website, but when I talk to the chef, he says, well, if we're going to do beef, we're going to do that Texas style because that's what they're good at. But we also serve pork, so we want to do that Carolina style because that's what's good there. So it is this sort of unholy mashup of different styles.
And then I can just imagine there'll be all sorts of different. Well, there already are. There's already Korean barbecue, as we said. I mean.
Yeah.
Is there Mexican barbecue?
Yeah. Actually, there is. There's the South Texas style is much more Mexican influenced. And they tend to sometimes use goat or lamb, maybe. Mm-hmm. I've been seeing a lot of mention lately of barbecue tamales, and that's sort of just where you stuff the tamale with whatever you've barbecued. That's something that's becoming a little bit more popular in the past few years, which, you know, as with anything in Los Angeles, we love to mash up different styles of food and just slam them together.
Sounds so delicious. I'm so hungry. Okay. So Barrel and Ashes, and any others that you really like?
Well, Maple Block recently opened up in the Culver City area. Going back to the Texas Monthly barbecue editor, he says that it was the best brisket that he had had in California. And I emailed him and I said, are you damning us with faint praise or do you actually mean that it's good? And he assured me that he meant it's actually good and it would hold up in Texas. That style is extremely Texan. It's drier. The main flavor of that is smoky. But what's great about that place is that they have all these sides of dishes that you might not find elsewhere in Los Angeles. I had my first pimento cheese sandwich there, which is very exciting.
Wow, I've never even heard of that.
It's just cheese product mixed with mayo, some chopped pimentos. I feel like they might have anchovy paste in it or something just for a little extra flavor. I know, I'm not selling it. Just try it. It's so good. It's like after school snack. They cut it into triangles with the crust cut off on white bread. Boy, it doesn't sound good, but I promise it was quite exciting.
Well, sounds good to me. It's lunchtime. Catherine Spires is a food writer and host of the podcast, How It Got in Your Mouth, which you can download for free wherever you get your podcasts, and you should do that. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hello, Jolie Myers here with the listener feedback.
Hello.
Speaking of food.
I am here, and our listeners have coalesced today around an egregious mishap on our show, and it's that we didn't mention Santa Maria-style barbecue during that segment. And so this is a very specific, it's okay, we're okay, but it's a very specific California-style barbecue. It goes back to the Mission system, and it centers around tri-tip. So you season it with black pepper, salt, garlic salt, grill it over the coals of a Native Coast live oak, and Bob's your uncle. Yeah. So
wow.
There actually used to be a place in Culver City that was called Santa Maria Barbecue. I think they only do catering now. They don't have a storefront, but if you guys are looking for it, all I'm saying is that's delicious. But myself, I'm a Kansas City style gal.
Yeah,
so
I agree.
Do you're yeah.
I'm with you.
Yeah, and I think that this is probably, like, the real barbecue fans are going to cringe, but sweet barbecue sauce all the
and
way.
And plus the vinegar.
Vinegar, sweet vinegar. Yeah, it's what I'm talking about. But yeah, so give it a try, the Santa Maria barbecue. So listeners, there you go.
There
a
you
complete
go.
Experience today on Press Play.
Thank you very much, Jolie Myers. If you want to weigh in on anything, we'd love to hear from you. Twitter at KCRW Press Play, Facebook KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.